You are a young boy when your mother goes missing. Despite your age, you know what happened to her, but your relatives do not believe you. Eventually, as an adult, you are pivotal in finding out what happened to your mother and bringing the perpetrator to justice. You are vindicated at last. This is the case of Bonnie Hame, and this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello everyone and welcome back to the Murder Me Monday podcast. I'm Cameron and joined with me is Mother.
Hello.
So by the time you listen to this, it might be a week out of date. But if you subscribe to us on Patreon, which you can find in the show notes, it will be a bit more up to date. I want to talk about the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp trial.
That's all we've talked about every night this week, isn't
it? It's hugely topical. It's all over the place and it's really interesting.
Absolutely fascinating. And there's a direct correlation, weirdly, for the next case that I'm currently researching with the meme that's going around with the objection to his own question for her lawyer.
Objection, hearsay. And as a lawyer, you kind of want the person that you're asking the question to hearsay, don't you? Because you can kind of confirm the point you're trying to make.
As your own witness.
Yeah, you'd rely on the opposition would then say hearsay, but you want them to hearsay,
yeah.
which is really weird. You're just on the autopilot. But I've fallen madly in love with the doctor that he had, the psychiatrist. She just clapped the cheeks of Amber Heard's lawyers. She just bodied them completely. She just, anytime the lawyer would say something, she said, no, that is not correct. What I said was this. Or, no, I was not hired by Johnny Depp. I was retained by Johnny Depp's legal team. And she's just fucking, she's so good. Like, I mean, who's not going to fall in love with an attractive blonde doctor?
But she's married, Pam.
Yeah, I know, she's married. And I actually went, as if I had the chance. So I'm like, weird man from England, with the chance of this like famous psychiatrist woman. I know Amber Heard's legal team shit the bed, but for Amber Heard to actually shit the bed, how good in bed or attractive do you have to be to shit the bed and someone go, yeah, it's all right though, isn't it? You put up with it.
And it was the
magic vagina. I can't.
She blamed it on the bloody teacup Yorkies.
I was going to say, did they even have a dog for her to blame it to?
Yeah, they had a teacup. That's what the doorman, when she was trying to claim that somebody was trying to break into the apartment, and he goes up there to check and he's vaping in his car while he's testifying to the court.
Oh, in the courts, yeah.
Yeah, and saying that the scratches were on the door were 4 inches above the floor. It was the dog trying to get in. But, I mean, what was the dog doing out in the hallway?
Well, it depends on what sort of penthouse it is, because they could have a hallway within the whole house, couldn't they? Because it's essentially true. Like a whole floor of these things. But the most telling part for me was when the police report, where the policewoman said that there was no evidence of a crime, so no police report was submitted. Johnny Depp wasn't even on site when Amber Heard was having claimed that he'd done this stuff.
Yeah.
And that to me was just like an astonishing part. I'm like, why is this even here? Just throw it out.
So if you're listening to this in the past, we will probably be talking next week because Amber Heard will be going on the stand this coming week.
It will be her turn on the stand. Looking like a weird air hostess cadet thing with her hair up, looking like she's been kicked in the tits because she just does not look happy.
No, she's not.
And Johnny Depp sat there giggling. I can't believe she said Johnny Depp has no style or class. Have you seen that man?
I think every woman under the age of 60 still would. Pretty much.
I'd date Johnny Depp. he's got no style. I know he does that advert for the
Au Sauvage.
Yeah, sausage, as I keep calling it, because that's how I read it. Oh, God. That just triggered me. And I want to talk about it briefly. But yeah, getting on to the case, Mother.
Right. So we've got a complex case. A missing person with a lot of twists along the way to its final resolution. Jacksonville, Florida, USA. Bonnie Lynn Paciotto Hame, born the 21st of May, 1969. She was an accountant, married with one young son called Aaron, and she worked for her husband's aunt's construction supply company, and her husband Michael worked there too. Michael was verbally abusive towards Bonnie at work on at least one occasion. The abuse turned physical when he slammed her hand in a car door. She had been planning to leave him for several months. She opened up a bank account under her own name. In order to hide it from him, she had the statements mailed to work. That was in the days when you still got paper bank statements. Somehow he found out about that. He was furious. He ordered her to close it. Although she did so, she still planned on leaving him. She began leaving money with friends. She also put a deposit on an apartment and enrolled their son, Aaron, in a new preschool. Bonnie returned to her marital home on Dolphin Avenue in Jacksonville, Florida, on the 6th of January 1993 at approximately 7:30 p.m. She was scheduled to meet Michael's aunt, who the one that she worked for, at her home at 8 o'clock to finalise plans for a friend's baby shower. But she phoned her at 8:30, said she would not be coming as planned because she was crying and she was upset. Bonnie told the aunt that she and Michael had gotten into an argument, but she would talk to her at work in the morning. That following morning, Michael called a co-worker and said that they wouldn't be coming into work. He was ill and Bonnie had left the previous night. According to him, she left around 11 p.m. He claimed that he had his mother come over later on to watch Aaron while he went looking for Bonnie. He came back after just 45 minutes and did not report her missing that night. Bonnie's handbag was found in a bin behind the Airport Red Roof Inn, which was about 5 miles away from their home, by a maintenance guy the next morning. It still contained $150 in cash, the credit cards, a checkbook, and other personal items. I don't know how Michael was told they'd been found, but he was told, and then reported her as missing to the police. Interestingly enough, I think he was forced into that because according to his aunt, who didn't really seem to like him much and was very much on Bonnie's side of the relationship, Michael was concerned about the money Bonnie was hiding from him and not bothered that she was missing.
I was going to ask, whose side is the aunt on in this situation? Is it Bonnie or Michael's?
Yeah, she's on Bonnie's side, even though she's Michael's, you know, relative.
And they both work with her, with the construction company. Do you know if it's successful, if it's going well?
Yeah. He was some kind of supervisor and she worked as an accountant for them.
So they're doing pretty well then, by the sounds of it, especially in like 1993, 1992-ish.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, they're doing all right. Bonnie's car is an 8-month-old Toyota Camry, and it was found in the long-term parking lot at Jacksonville International Airport. Authorities noticed that the driver's seat was pushed further back than what would have been comfortable for her. She was only about 5'3"-ish. It's in a position fitting someone much taller, like possibly Michael. After examining it, authorities found a shoe print on the driver's side floor.
I googled what a 1992, 1993 Toyota Camry is. That is every car that's in like a Top Gun, Die Hard movie from back in the day. You picture a car from the 90s, fam, it's this.
I've got to admit, I've seen pictures. And I've seen pictures of this footprint. It's quite a distinctive print and it's prominent. It was determined that it belonged to the last person who'd driven the car because it wasn't brushed off. It was...
Where is the print?
It's right beside the pedals. You can actually see it on the floor. You know, someone's stepped into the car.
I thought if they're going to say it's somewhere weird, like in the back.
No.
Because who goes in the back in that case to disturb the footprint?
Yeah. And it was found to match a specific type of sport shoe that Michael had. And it had a mixture of sand and plant material taken from the print, which was the same source of material collected from Michael's shoe.
Would it not be possible to play it off that he'd driven it about because it was also his wife's car, so it seems normal to do?
That's what his father tried to say.
I tried to look at it from this instance when I know that this is kind of how it's going because it's in a podcast, right? It's fucking, why are you talking about him if he didn't do it? So yeah, I tried to look at it from in this case of if they are innocent, what would their defense then be? I don't know why that's my brain does. It's not to be contrarian or devil's advocate. I try to think, fuck, what if I was in this instance? What would I say to get out of it?
The point is, if he had driven it, why was it at the airport? Why was the print pristine? It was literally as if somebody had put their foot down and then just, it hadn't been touched afterwards. But
why would you abandon a car in the airport?
The presumption would have been to try and indicate that she had left, jumped on a plane, because Americans jump on planes the same as we do on trains.
Yeah, especially if it's international, which we said before, you don't need a passport for it even.
Well, you do for international, but not national flights.
Oh, yeah, sorry, not within the States.
Yeah, and it wasn't, I got that wrong, sorry, it wasn't his father that said that. It was Bonnie's own father that insisted that the shoe print meant nothing.
Which would make sense. You try to defend your...
son-in-law.
Yeah, because you wouldn't think he did it.
Well, Yeah, exactly. And so far, all we've got is circumstantial, isn't it? But little Aaron was spoken to by child psychologists. He was 3. So he said daddy had killed mummy in an argument.
Objection, hearsay.
He said he saw it. He said that Michael had forced him to come along with him in the car when he disposed of a body, and Michael had thrown a shotgun out of the car shortly after killing Bonnie.
I'm frowning. Why would you take your son? Why would you chuck the shotgun out the window? And why would you take your son? That you could have left him fucking anywhere.
Well, he could have left him at home with his mother, theoretically, because he said that he got his mother over to look after Aaron while he went looking for Bonnie.
I know a follow-up question would be, where was he? Where would Michael then be if you dropped the kid off to, I assume, looking for her? Well, no, but she would have, yeah, I guess.
Yeah. But Aaron is a little kid. The authorities believed him, but they couldn't prove anything. And the biggest problem was they didn't have a body. And that's the recurring theme through all of this. Michael has maintained his innocence in his wife's disappearance from the case's onset, so it sort of all went cold. Little Aaron is in the foster system at this point. He had initially been placed with Bonnie's sister, but eventually put into the system. The authorities were able to get him taken away on the suspicion that his father was guilty, and it was to keep Aaron safe from his own father, Michael. He didn't go to the grandparents, as both sets of parents are a huge problem. Bonnie's dad's initial reaction to that shoe print sort of thing, that the police weren't comfortable with it. 1995, 2 years after his mother went missing, Aaron, who would have been around 5, showed his foster mother the bridge that he thought his father had thrown the gun from. They were literally driving around, and he suddenly goes to her, that's the bridge, that's the bridge.
I was going to say, if he's specifically taken her there, that's quite traumatic.
Yeah.
This is a weirdly like prophetic child, isn't he? He's a 3-year-old. He said, dad's done it. He's now 5. He's still adamant dad's done it. Taken to the bridge. So that's quite impressive.
So this foster mother believed him. She reported it. The river was searched, and sure enough, a gun was found.
Why didn't they do that in the first place?
Because it was a random bridge off a random road.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah.
They determined that it had been there for at least 2 years. It also matched an identical gun found at Michael's house. But again, not proof of anything. It wasn't a part of a pair, but it was exactly the same as one he already had.
Bet he's regretting bringing their kid with him now, isn't he?
Well.
His kid's fucking Rain Man and knew exactly where it was.
In an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in 1996, Bonnie's father appeared. And, well, his demeanour bothered viewers. He was defending Michael, fair enough, like Cameron said, son-in-law, you know, saying the shoe print evidence meant nothing. He thought Bonnie was still alive, had left entirely voluntarily, leaving her son, which is incredibly unusual. Mothers don't usually do that. Does happen, but, you know. And he also didn't believe what 3-year-old Aaron had told investigators. He said, the credibility of a child is something that you have to judge in perspective. He said a couple of things that we know were not true. Mum's car's in the lake. We know a car wasn't there. But it was his smile that seemed to bother the viewers more than anything. He smirked. So the lake comment. Aaron was 3. And he could have gotten confused with a lake and a swimming pool, maybe. They had a swimming pool at their house. In 1999... Bonnie Haim was declared legally dead. Aaron was adopted by his foster family, and his name was changed to Aaron Fraser. Michael's parental rights were terminated. The judge felt that Aaron was at risk of abuse because he was the only living witness to Bonnie's murder. That was actually in the court transcripts. As a child, Aaron drew pictures of his father shooting his mother in the stomach. And according to his adoptive mother, Aaron wrote an essay in 8th grade describing her murder and how Michael's parents helped Michael dispose of her body. He said, I was in the house looking out the window at my mum and dad. I was standing on my tippy toes. I watched as he shot her. I thought to myself, no, don't shoot her. That's my mum or mom. Aaron goes on to describe how his father took off his mother's jewellery, put her in the car, threw the gun in a creek and went to bury her. John Haim is Michael's father and he made statements to the press. This is made up gossip. That is all it is. If any of that stuff were even one tenth true, he'd have been done in jail. I'm innocent, my wife's innocent, my son's innocent. It's not true, so it really doesn't upset me. He said neither his son nor anyone else in their family had done anything to do with Bonnie Haim's disappearance or death. He said Aaron was coached to make up these stories. The Haims, so Dad John, Michael and his mother, all moved to East Tennessee from Jacksonville. But Michael kept his old house and rented it out. While Michael was not charged with Bonnie's murder, circumstantial evidence is a lower entry point in civil cases. And the testimony from Aaron was allowed in. So it was enough for a family court ruling in September of 2004 that Michael Haim killed his wife. And it was Aaron's adopted family who took that to court for him on his behalf. In April of 2005, Michael was ordered to pay $26.3 million for a wrongful death suit. He said, Cameron's face at the sound of that money.
Why is it so much?
Punitive damages. They'll never recover it.
But especially back then, I don't understand. I don't understand why that sum is so high.
It's they're given scales and it's punitive damages.
I know the burden of proof is lower in civil court than it is in criminal court, but for you to have one but not the other seems kind of odd to me.
Mm. So in April 2005, Michael was ordered to pay that money, as I said. And as part of the settlement, Aaron received the house where he previously lived with Michael and Bonnie. I believe it was put into a trust for him. And that was all they got, I think. The family did say that they didn't expect to collect in full. And it was more about vindicating what Aaron had been saying for all those years.
It's the principle of it.
Yeah.
This whole time, him saying it happened. Here's the evidence of it. This kid going through the trauma of it.
Yeah.
I'd be pretty concerned from even just Michael's side than his parents that the grandson or his child in this case is going to be traumatized horrifically.
Yeah. Well, the foster parents were absolutely amazing to him.
I was going to say, he hit the gold mine with those.
Yeah, he did.
A kid that's already been traumatized into the foster system, traumatic itself, then getting into like a foster home can be traumatic. But then this kid hit the gold mine. He's got these parents that are supporting him.
Absolutely.
And taking him along the way. Man, that's lucky. That's lottery tier.
They had him in therapy from day one. He was self-suffering from nightmares. He really did suffer. I'll go over it a bit later. But yeah, they were absolutely, you know, an amazing family for him. And he really needed to land on his feet after what he'd been through. So Michael never appeared at that civil trial. And his attorney, who represented him for a bit, also later withdrew. So there's nothing going on. So, you know, it was basically a default judgment against him. He just wouldn't engage with it. And it's then reported that during renovations at the Haim family home and specifically to the pool area in December of 2014, workers located a skull in the backyard. It was later identified as a human one. Yet again, Bonnie's dad said the pool had been there before Bonnie moved in, so the remains couldn't be hers. In August of 2015, DNA tests on that skull and additional remains that were found were positively identified as Bonnie, 21 years after she went missing. Interestingly, on a 2000 lease for the property, remember I said he rented that house out, Michael specifically prohibited the renters from touching Aaron's room or using it in any way. And they were not allowed to make any changes to the backyard, whether it's planting flowers or installing anything, say like a brick-built barbecue or something like that.
Would you want to rent a house where you can't access one of the rooms?
No, people do. There's a weird case in the papers this week. This house has been sold with They can't use the basement. There's somebody living in the basement. They've never had a lease. They've never paid any rent. They can't get them out. And the house actually sold for more money than it was on the market for. Really weird one, but yeah.
Depending on where it is in America, that can make sense because the market is insane at the minute.
Yeah. So a couple and their dog rented the house from Michael for about 2 years in the late 1990s after Bonnie disappeared.
Why, when you said that, did I assume that the dog would be on the lease as well? A couple and their dog. Specifically the dog. He's pitching in.
Yeah, they have very different rules over there. They seem to have a much better right to life with pets in the USA than we do over here. Even though they've changed the legislation over here, it's still pretty useless. If you struggle to rent if you've got pets. So this guy who rented it said, every time the dog would go out, he would circle the pool. He would just keep running laps around the pool. And in certain areas, he would just stop and look at the ground and he would bark. So that sort of threw some red flags up. But he said he never had any reservations about moving into the house. But after talking with some of his new neighbours, he admitted he grew suspicious of his landlord. He said he only met Michael twice and described him as odd and shady. Going back to those remains that were identified as being Bonnie, they found a 22 caliber shell. And Michael owned a rifle of that type at the time of Bonnie's disappearance. I'm assuming that gun that I've never found it anywhere, that the gun that they found on the bridge was the same type. So something that puzzled me about the finding of the body was that the property records indicated that the pool was built in 1959, and so was the house. So how and when and where was her body exactly found? Were they going to remodel the pool or were they relining it? But that was actually bad reporting. Yes, I went digging in an awful lot of places. That was a horrible turn of phrase, but you know what I mean. Bonnie wasn't found in the pool, but Aaron himself found her skull about 6 inches down under a paving slab in the yard. He had gone to renovate the house with a relative.
6 inches?
6 inches.
Man didn't even dig deep?
No.
Oh, my God.
They had begun by deciding to smash apart the swimming pool at the back with a rented excavator. I'm assuming, you know, pools are expensive to maintain. They're expensive to fill. It's probably not a good point for a house anymore to have a pool.
And at that point, people might not want to rent it because of the costs that are incurred. That,
exactly. Yeah. So at one point, this excavator...
I can't believe it was only 6 inches in the ground. How long does that take to dig up 6 inches? It takes about 2 minutes. You could have done a little bit deeper.
Well...
Oh, my God.
This machine cracked a large concrete slab, which was near an outdoor shower. And Aaron began hacking at it with a sledgehammer, like you kind of do. I can imagine, you know, you just...
So when was this? Because you said...
December 2014.
So they had found the skull, and then that's when they used the more recent DNA testing things to...
Yeah.
To then...
But this is how they found the skull.
So how old would Aaron have been at this point?
In his early 20s.
I was going to say. Yeah. Because if he's like 1993 when she died, and he was 3, he would be about 24,
yeah,
wouldn't he?
Yeah. So they smash in at this slab, and he goes at it with a, you know, sledgehammer. And he's pulling up the slab, and he didn't realise what he had. He pulled something up, and it was in a bag. And he said he ripped the bag... And he thought, why would somebody bury a coconut in a bag? It looked like a coconut shell. He had it in his hands. They looked back into the hole where they'd pulled this bag out and they saw teeth in the hole. So on the 24th of August 2015, Michael was arrested in North Carolina and charged with Bonnie's murder. He was extradited back to Jacksonville, where he pled not guilty to the charges against him. He was held without bail, being judged a flight risk. But eventually, his lawyers managed to argue to the appeals court in Tallahassee that he only faced second-degree murder charges. He posed no risk, flight or otherwise. He was released on $200,000 bail, but ordered to stay away from all of Bonnie's family who were still in the area. But he had to stay in Florida. He had wanted to go back to North Carolina with his wife. Yes, he remarried in October of 2013, and his new wife was standing by him. So second-degree murder is non-premeditated. It's resulting from an assault in which death of the victim was a distinct possibility. First-degree murder, which is premeditated, intentional killing, or results from a crime such as arson, rape, or armed robbery. Exact distinctions on degree vary by which state you're in. In 2016, Michael's lawyers tried to get statements made by Aaron thrown out on the basis that they differed or were contradictory. Aaron told the investigators during an interview a day after Bonnie's disappearance that nothing had happened to his mother. Then, according to the defence, after several hours of prodding, he told the police his father pushed her to the ground and ran her over with his car. He also claimed his father shot her, but the defence said because of his age, he may not have known the difference between a lie or the truth, and said his competency was never assessed. He was 3 years old. Of course, it would bloody differ. Why would you assess competency on a three-year-old? But anyway, that didn't work. But they managed to get him a Christmas holiday. He was allowed to go back to North Carolina from the 22nd of December to the 3rd of January 2017 to spend it with his wife. But he had to be back from the 3rd of January. But then in July of 2017, they let him move back with his wife, but he had to come back to Florida for all of the hearings. After several delays, his trial eventually began on the 8th of April 2019. The court was shown pictures of the remains, including one of a finger bone with what appeared to be a wedding ring on it. It also turned out that in 1995, police were sent an anonymous letter saying that Bonnie's body is in the backyard. Bring the cadaver dogs quick. And the police said they didn't have probable cause to recheck it. So basically, if they missed it the first time, tough luck. The stamp on the letter was checked for DNA. They can determine it's male, but that's all. And it's not Michael. There was a lot of suspicion beforehand that it was the foster mother or the adoptive mother of Aaron that had sent the letter. But the DNA tests at trial proved it was male. So who it was, we still don't know. Several witnesses, including Aaron, testified against Michael. Aaron was asked during the trial if when he picked up her skull, if it was the only physical interaction remembered with his biological mother, to which he answered yes. Two jailhouse informants also testified that he had confessed to killing Bonnie and burying her body in the backyard. One stated that he even feared for his safety while sharing a jail cell with him. Of course, the defence tried to discredit them, spent at least 2 minutes detailing their arrest records, the aliases that they had used, and their history of not telling the truth. There is nothing that I can find that says that they were promised any inducements for their testimony, and they often stop doing that as a grounds for appeal. They won't offer, you know, I'll testify for you if you give me 6 months off or move me to somewhere closer near my family. They've stopped doing that to stop trials being overturned. Michael's defence tried to make out that Bonnie was moved to that grave at her former home at a later date, as if someone had fitted Michael up. The medical examiner's office said they couldn't tell if it was a first or secondary grave site, which was a problem. Turned out, whilst most of Bonnie's remains were just bones, roots and string, they did find jewellery, sweatpants and a Mickey Mouse poncho that she was wrapped in. They also found that her acrylic nails had survived, and yet for some reason the medical examiner hand swabbed them, which the defence pounced on. They didn't find any DNA on that stuff. So Michael's mother testified in his defence, said he was brought up in a Christian household and was never any bother and never showed any violence.
Because Christians have never done anything wrong or been violent to anyone ever.
Yep.
Historically, never.
A former neighbour said he was kind, giving, loving, generous and had never displayed a temper or violence. Another three neighbours say the same thing. A former childhood friend said the same thing as the wife of a former colleague says. He was like a son to her. His current wife said she'd never been afraid of him. Michael testified in his own defence, denying any responsibility for Bonnie's disappearance and the murder. I left my wife. It wasn't me. The prosecution said it was a personal and intimate murder, and there is not one other person that had any motive. And for her body to be found at her old home was the seal on the deal.
How did they determine that? That doesn't seem to make any sense. What makes it a personal murder?
There was nobody.
Well, intimate murder, they said.
It was known that Michael was violent. It was known that Michael was aggressive. It was known that she was looking to leave him, which is the most dangerous time for someone leaving a relationship. It was the fact that she was found at her old home, and Aaron saying all his accounts were slightly different, yes, but he was consistent with it was dad killed mum.
They made the assumption this was the second burial site, wasn't it? The second place the body
was found. The medical examiner couldn't say.
They couldn't determine.
They couldn't determine, okay. No. And the defence tried to say that somebody had fitted Michael up by moving her back. What bothered... Well, I'll go into that in a minute. There was some really weirdness that came out about that as well. So on April the 12th, he was found guilty of second degree murder after the jury deliberated for 90 minutes. And I bet that included a lunch break too. Because he was found guilty, the jury also had to decide on some other points based around the law as it was in 1993, which were more lenient than the current law. That often happens.
Why would that make a difference?
You have to. It's quite common.
Why?
That's just the rule. If the crime occurred at a different date and the law was different then, they usually have to sentence under what the law was then. That's very, very common. And if they don't do it, they have to be really specific why they're not doing it. And this is what this judge does. I'll get into it and I'll explain it all.
Can you see my confusion as to why that makes sense? Like, you committed the crime then, but you weren't punished for it at the time. Say the punishment for the crime has gone up or down, depending on wherever. Yeah. Why wouldn't you be punished by the standards of today? Because what about if that's the argument, then committing crimes back then wasn't a crime. But then if no one found out about the crime until now, would you then just be let off?
That's where the ruling is.
But why?
It just is.
Because if it was bad, if it wasn't deemed bad then, but it's still deemed bad now, that actually means it was in fact bad back then as well, just times hadn't caught up. So why is it not a crime now, if that's the case? It seems backwards. It seems weird to me.
You could have the same argument over some of the sexual offences that are now being prosecuted that were... It was different behaviour back then that people didn't think it was a problem, whereas now it's a problem and people are being prosecuted for stuff. So
yeah, in today's time, though. So yeah. That goes to what I'm saying.
I know. I've got no answer for you.
Fucking stupid.
So according to 1993 rules, the guidelines for second-degree murder ranged from 7 to 22 years. The state wants what's called an upward departure from that. And it would have to prove an aggravator, like the crime is heinous, atrocious or cruel to do so. So the jury decision on the four aggravating factors, the crime. Was it committed in front of a family member? Yes, Aaron. Was it committed during the commission of tampering with evidence? They ruled yes. Was it committed in this heinous, atrocious, cruel manner? They said no. And did it inflict severe emotional trauma on the victim, Aaron, and the victim's family? Yes. So during impact statements to the court, Aaron talked about how he had been going to therapy all of his life. He stated that he was also dealing with depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, in addition to suicidal thoughts since he was 16 years old. Aaron said that he had no memory of the events that occurred when he was 3 years old, but how he had slept with a brick under his pillow as a child as he felt something was coming for him. He searched all his life for where his mother was buried. How once during an interview, when he was a child, when he had been asked what his mother was wearing when he'd last seen her, and he had replied, blood. how his grandparents on both sides said he had been indoctrinated and was being manipulated, how they loved him and wanted to see him, but he wanted nothing to do with them. Michael only expressed sorrow and shed tears when his current loved ones spoke about his character. There was no emotion shown at all for any of the other victim impact statements. On the 21st of May 2019, the judge departed from the 1993 sentencing guidelines in his sentencing order, and that was 11 pages long. The judge is keenly aware that any deviation from the 1993 low sentencing guidelines would be appealed by the defence. And Michael was then sentenced to life in prison. Michael Haim was 53 years old. But we are not done. Of course not. The 30th of April, 2021, Michael appealed. He argued that the trial court erred in not excluding a statement made by his son near the time of the murder, in not excluding a shell casing found near the victim's body, and imposing that upward departure sentence, so ignoring the sentencing guidelines.
So he's doing what I said. The judge is doing what I said.
Yeah, and Michael's gone and said, no, we need to go back to, yeah. So Michael sought to also exclude the introduction of the 22 caliber shell found where the investigators unearthed Bonnie's remains. He argued that there was no nexus, between the casing and the crime, because the cause of the victim's death was undetermined. And investigators could not link the casing to any weapon owned by him when it had been buried for over 21 years. And, you know, they haven't got anything from him back then. The court denied the motion. It found that the casing was relevant and highly probative because it tended to prove the victim's cause of death, where the shooting occurred, and was consistent with an injury to the victim's hip bone, which a forensic anthropologist testified to at trial, that they could not be sure that a gunshot caused the defect, but it resembled a gunshot wound. So it looks like a gunshot on the hip. We can't say it's a gunshot wound on the hip, but that's what we think it is.
It sounds like a horse, but it could be a zebra.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the appeal transcript went to 11 pages, just like the sentencing judge's remarks. All points were denied and his sentence was confirmed. So I do have a few questions, though. Why did Michael leave her there? Surely to God he would have realised at some point someone could have found her. Why not remove the remains and rebury her in East Tennessee in the wilds of somewhere when he moved there with his parents? I don't get that one. Why did Aaron decide to smash up the pool? We've talked about the cost of it, but did he subconsciously know?
Or he said that he'd been looking for his mother's remains or subconsciously looking for his mother's remains for his whole life.
Yeah.
But to then find them doing a little side quest in your life of remodeling the back garden, to then find your parents' remains, that's, again, some kind of, I don't want to say stroke of luck because it's not, but it is.
It gave him closure, though, didn't it?
Yeah.
And it completely and utterly vindicated, which is what I said in the beginning, didn't I? So who wrote that anonymous letter to the police?
So I was going to ask this, or I had my suspicions. Is it one of the parents?
What, the anonymous letter?
Yeah.
We still don't know. Or we know it's male.
Because you said it's male, but in this time, because Michael's parents and then Bonnie's parents, I'm not sure if they'll be alive or not at this point.
I don't know.
But would they have been checked? Because it could be that if the parents are behind him, then maybe he did reveal it was...
They probably didn't test the stamp for mitochondrial DNA or, you know, the DNA for the relatives, but they knew it wasn't Michael's. Maybe if they tested against Aaron and they found some links, they could have said it was one of the grandparents from the association from it. So we don't know. I think you get to a point with some investigations where they don't go any further because they've got enough that they need and it's just more expense.
They don't need to further investigate when what the conclusion they've come to already confirms their hypothesis.
I also don't know whether Michael's parents were ever investigated after Aaron saying that they helped move his mother's body. And I don't know whether her parents, specifically her dad, ever said sorry for all the stuff they said about their own daughter. So that $26 million wrongful death suit, I'm guessing, and it's purely a guess, but Michael's new wife wouldn't be on the hook for half of the marital assets for that, would she? Was there some kind of attachment of her earnings order? So how was he paying it? I don't know. The house. The mortgage probably wasn't paid off when it was handed over to Aaron. So who was paying for the remainder? I don't know.
Probably his foster parents at this point.
Yeah.
Because for them, and this isn't looking at it selfishly from their perspective, but it is then an asset that they then acquire. Because the mortgage that wasn't paid off, they then acquire what had been paid off essentially, don't they?
Mm.
Arbitrary, 200 grand, 150 is paid off, they've only got the 50. But then they've now got this backlog of 150 that they've got in the bank essentially for Aaron when he gets older. Because everything they've done so far seems to be for his benefit.
Yes. Yeah. So did Aaron keep the house after all of this? I know he's married. Would you want to live there? It's also where he found his mum. I only hope his mental health hasn't deteriorated further, because this is one messed up case, poor fella. There are Dateline episodes on this, and also my current favourite on the ID channel, which is Evil Lives Here. And I believe that there are a couple of books if anybody wants to deep dive on this one.
Aside from just all the trauma that this
poor boy,
poor guy has accepted for the whole thing, but I'm just happy for him that he had this family. I know I've said it before, but the amount of times that people get put into the foster system that then come out worse because they can be victims of abuse. But this guy hit the lottery.
He definitely did.
And this case reminds me of one that we covered before, the Ulyssa Shavers case, where there was a dog found it under the patio or something.
It was in the flower garden, wasn't it? And she'd put a couple of them away like that. Now, that got me thinking, because the letter that was sent to the police said, send the cadaver dogs. I'm assuming they tried with cadaver dogs after she went missing. But again, it's an assumption. I've got nowhere to actually say that they actually did check the house. And we're talking in the 1990s. The forensics, the CSI type stuff is not there the same as it is now, is it?
No, I don't think DNA was used until the 80s.
And all the rest of it. They wouldn't have, yeah.
So just for conclusion, to wrap it all up, he has been sentenced to life in prison.
Yes.
With any chance of parole? Well, it's life and he's in his 50s, so probably not.
Exactly. The last appeal was last year, so he may try again.
He was only sentenced a few years ago, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Do you like peak corona times?
Yeah.
But that's the end of the podcast. However, we got some stuff to say, Mother.
Well, we are now live on Patreon. And thank you very much to our first Patreon, Angela. Much appreciated. We will also be recording extra content at that level that you subscribe to, Angela. So there will be something coming out in May. So finally, the victim who should not be forgotten. Bonnie Lynn Haim, aged 23.
So you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Murder Me Monday Podcast. You can find us on Patreon at MMOM. It'll be in the show notes, descriptions, etc. Episodes early. Gmail. Email us at murdermemondaypodcast@gmail.com. Much love and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Peace.